right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Richard Booth. He is an independent journalist, and he has specialized in the cover-up and the real story behind the Oklahoma City bombing of April 19th, 1995. And we have now, at the Libertarian Institute, reproduced his entire research archive of documents and very good journalistic reports on this story. And all of that is available at libertarianinstitute.org/OKC. We'll have every single thing you need. And it's really mostly a repository of firsthand sources of documents for researchers to base their journalism off of. And there's some good journalism in there too, but it's a lot of raw intelligence, as they would put it, and absolutely can serve as the basis of all kinds of new great investigative journalist reports, if investigative journalists would feel so inclined to do so. For example, Richard's article that we're running on the Libertarian Institute front page right now, Timothy McVeigh, Suspects, Visit Strip Club in Weeks Before Bombing. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Richard?
Very good. Thank you for having me, Scott.
Man, I can't tell you how much I appreciate all the work that you've put into this and then letting us mirror it all at the Libertarian Institute. We'll be keeping this archive for safekeeping from now on at libertarianinstitute.org/OKC. But let's start with this article. McVeigh went to the strip club, and he was with some people, and none of them were Terry Nichols. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. About a week, a little over a week before the bombing in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there's a strip club there called Lady Godiva's. And this was a story that came out more than a year after the bombing, but it's one that was followed up on by an Oklahoma journalist named J.D. Cash, excellent journalist, also followed up on by a Canadian film crew for their program, The Fifth Estate, which is kind of like our 60 Minutes. And basically, McVeigh went to this club, and he had two people with him that were not Terry Nichols, and that is obviously very interesting to look to see who he's hanging out with, you know, that close to the bombing. And what makes this encounter so special is that the club had an audio and video surveillance system in the dancers' prep room. You know, it cuts down on crime. It was kind of for safety purposes. And when the owner of the club was reviewing the tape, he saw and heard an encounter between his server and one of the dancers. It was a bit alarming to him. And this server was talking about an unusual customer that she had that evening, and she actually repeated to the dancer what this gentleman had told her. And what he told her was, is he said, "I'm a very smart man, and on April 19th, 1995, you'll remember me forever." And at the time, of course, it didn't really make a lot of sense. It sounded rather bizarre. But in retrospect, the owner of the club recognized immediately how serious it was, and he contacted the FBI, who did show up, and they did confiscate that tape. But not before J.D. Cash had made a copy of the tape and had given a copy to the Fifth Estate, and they ran a program on it. Now, for your listeners who are going to access this archive, they'll be able to look at the transcript of the Fifth Estate program. I have the transcript in there. I've got articles by J.D. Cash about the encounter and the audio tape. And then there's that short piece that I wrote that just kind of summarizes what happened. And it cites, at the end of this article I've written, it cites various pieces, and a person can go and they can look in the archive and they can look at all those primary sources themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then in the documentary by John Ronson, they feature the video itself in there. They have the clip of the girls talking. And people can see for themselves. And they also interview on camera the owner and his wife, I think, right?
That's right. The owner, Floyd Radcliffe, and his wife, Julie, are interviewed on camera in that documentary from Ronson, which it's about 18 years old now, but it's worth looking at. And that was also aired on the Canadian Fifth Estate program. They aired the clip. I've isolated it and got a copy of it up on YouTube. It's a short 2 or 3 minute segment from another documentary, a really good one that I recommend people look at, called Terror from Within, which came out in about 2002. And it focuses on McVeigh having been a neo-Nazi rather than this militia guy, which that's really what he was a neo-Nazi. And the people who were with him that night at that strip club, they were picked out of a photo lineup by the witnesses. J.D. Cash writes about this, and so does the Fifth Estate. These people in their investigation showed a photo lineups of multiple individuals to these people. The bottom line is one of these guys had a German accent, and he was very easily identified as a German national, a man named Andreas Strassmeier. And the third person was identified by photos, evidently, as Strassmeier's roommate at Elohim City, which is a gentleman by the name of Michael Brescia, who was a member of a neo-Nazi terrorist group at that very time.
Mm-hmm. And, and people will see that's just the beginning of that thread, and there's plenty of, you know, again, FBI documents, official government documents in the research archive here, where so many of these ties can be, you know, identified and solidified. It's pretty far beyond speculation to the realm of, I would say, beyond a reasonable or even beyond a shadow of a doubt that McVeigh was in conspiracy with these guys from the Aryan Republican Army to do this attack. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. My suspicion is that the members of the Aryan Republican Army, certain members, were involved in the bombing and, in fact, have been accused of having been involved in the bombing by other people in that group. When that group was busted by the FBI and most of them went to prison, several of them identified one or more particular members and said specifically, these guys had something to do with the Oklahoma City bombing. And so that's something that I think that people can look at, and they might be surprised to find out by looking at the news reports that the FBI also believed this. And in April of 1995, April 28th, newspaper reports ran which said that the FBI believed the bombing was financed through a series of unsolved Midwestern bank robberies, which, as it turns out, were robberies carried out by this so-called Aryan Republican Army. And so early on in the investigation, before the story kind of started changing, the FBI spoke to reporters, and you can read what they said to reporters, and you can read those earlier reports and see that they very much knew this was the work of four or five people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go ahead and add this very important quote from the book Oklahoma City by Roger Charles and his writing partner here, Andrew Gumbel, who's a reporter for The Guardian. And they wrote this book, Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. And on page 328, they have a quote here from Larry Mackey, who was a federal prosecutor who helped to prosecute Nichols. And, you know, this is a little bit unclear because of the double negatives and so forth kind of thing, the way he constructs it. But I think people can understand. He says, if you had said to us, anybody in the room 100% confident that McVeigh was alone, raise your hand, we would have all kept our hands in our laps.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, in other words, he and his entire team, he believes, never believed that this conspiracy was just Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. And they go on, I'm not sure if it's on the same page or not, but they make it clear that essentially their excuse is not the authors, but the people they're writing about. The feds' excuse was that they didn't want to jeopardize the death penalty case against McVeigh by pointing to the rest of the guilty. Because even though they all deserved at least life, they were worried that if they implicated anyone else, that that would jeopardize the death penalty case against McVeigh. And so they went ahead and made that decision that killing the probably the most important member of the plot, I think we agree about that, was more important than locking them all up for life, which sounds like government work to me. Although, you know, I've long suspected, and I think either of us could prove pretty easily, that it went beyond that, right? They had a real reason to cover up who all was involved because of other federal government employees' relationships with those co-conspirators.
Right. No, that I'm glad you bring that up because that's an excellent book on the bombing. I highly urge or recommend that people read that book. And it's true that the prosecutors were basically working with what they had, which is they have Timothy McVeigh. They can assemble a very good case against him because he absolutely was involved in this bombing and was one of the principals. But on the other hand, they knew that the FBI did not apprehend some of these other people. And to focus on that, to talk about it, or to otherwise highlight it would only cause skepticism in the minds of some jurors who might, well, could have been argued by the defense team that, oh, this guy McVeigh was just a foot soldier. He's just taking orders. Mm-hmm. So they really, really had to get away from that issue of other people. But I urge people to go just look at the archives, read the news reports and the FBI reports from April and May of 95, and then in May of 97. And 2 years after the bombing, there was a news cycle whereby about 2 weeks, over a period of 2 weeks, there were all news report after news report about a third suspect in the bombing. This is a man that the FBI investigated for 5 years to try to locate. A guy who went by the name of Robert Jacks was an alias that the man was using. And this man was trying to purchase property with McVeigh and Nichols that had a cave on it. And the FBI in that Ronson documentary that you mentioned, they've got a I think it was in that one. If not, it was in The Terror from Within. But they've got a quote from Bob Ricks at the FBI talking about this gentleman. And Ricks is saying, yeah, you know, we believe that they were looking for a place to hide with this guy. Mm-hmm. And this gentleman was, he, according to the witnesses, he was the boss man. He was the guy who did all the talking, asked most of the questions. McVeigh and Nichols were both there with him. And this third gentleman who went by the name Robert Jacks is somebody that the FBI never could locate. He becomes one of the first of the others unknown in this case, of which the FBI believed, and I believe, there were 4 to 5 of these other people.
Hey, y'all, check it out. The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published 3 great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, The Scott Horton Show Interviews, 2004 through 2019. Interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the good doctor over the years on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. Hey, you guys may know I'm involved in some Libertarian Party politics this year, but you can't hear or read about that at the Libertarian Institute due to 501c3 rules and such. So make sure to sign up for the interviews feed at scotthorton.org and keep an eye on my blog at scotthorton.org/stress. Hey y'all, Scott here. If you want a real education in history and economics, you should check out Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Tom and a really great group of professors and experts have put together an entire education of everything they didn't teach you in school, but should have. Follow through from the link in the margin at scotthorton.org for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Well, now, and I wanted to point out here real quick, too, that this cover-up that they describe as being so necessary to guarantee the conviction and death penalty case against McVeigh, it almost cost them a conviction against Terry Nichols. And the original vote was 10-2 to acquit Terry Nichols, who I think we both agree was guilty and was in on this. But what had happened was the government didn't prove it because they couldn't prove it without telling too much of the story. And so essentially they just tried to guilt trip the jury into going along with it, which eventually they did, but they found him guilty of, I think, just manslaughter or even involuntary manslaughter or something, rather than give the government the full murder conviction, the conspiracy and everything else that they were trying to get. And in fact, the McVeigh jury had the same problem. And in the archive, people can hear the audio clip that I had taken from 60 Minutes, where they interviewed one of McVeigh's jurors, where she is just purely rationalizing and says, well, you know, she's the subtext leading up to it is they never really proved a case at all. And so she says, well, I was just waiting for the defense to call someone to provide McVeigh an alibi and say it couldn't have been him because he was with me that day. And since that never happened, I figured that I guess he really did do it, right? In other words, the cops are really sure and they're guilting me into voting guilty, but they haven't convinced me. They have no evidence. Now the burden of proof is on the defendant to provide an alibi. Otherwise, he must have been the guy. And that's clearly her just filling in the gaps. Like when you're trying to make sense out of something George W. Bush said, you just have to put words in there to make it make sense. And that's what she does here. She just tries to figure out a way to make it make sense. And of course, you know, he was guilty, but the prosecution spent the whole time interviewing. I remember in one specific case, it was a little girl who had lost her mom and I think her auntie at the same time there and was like 9 years old and was wounded herself. And they put her on the stand and they ask her, you know, how do you feel ever since losing your family members? And she cries and says, I feel terrible. And they say, okay, thank you. No further questions. And this is how they convicted the guy, because they couldn't prove that his guilty ass was guilty without implicating. Again, these other Nazis were not unknown to the federal police before this whole thing happened. And what they call embarrassment that the rest of us would call, you know, criminal culpability comes into play here. That this is why we're not going after Richard Guthrie and Michael Brescia, is because they work for us, or they used to, and we supposedly were keeping tabs on them, this kind of deal.
Right. No, I'm glad you mentioned that, because at the trial, you're very correct insofar as that they had witness after witness that they brought in who were – these were people who were victims, and they just had a parade of victims, which was horrifying to see the real human toll and the number of people who died or were maimed in this bombing. But the one thing that stands out to me and to any other student who might look at this case is they will find no one – was called who pointed to Timothy McVeigh in the courtroom and said, that's the man I saw at the scene of the crime. Not a single person did that. And that was not for a lack of witnesses, because as the reader will see, or as the listener will see, if they go look in the archive, they're going to find FBI 302 reports, which are witness interviews with witness after witness after witness who saw Timothy McVeigh at the scene of the crime.
It's at least 24 different eyewitnesses, right, that saw him that morning?
They had at least 24 – FBI had at least 24 that they felt were solid. One of these witnesses the FBI had pointed him out of a real live lineup downtown at the Oklahoma City command post. He said, pointed at this guy and said, that's him right there, pointed McVeigh out. This gentleman had a discussion with McVeigh that morning, and there was another man sitting in the Ryder truck at that time. That was a problem that the prosecution faced, is if they called any one of these witnesses and that witness put McVeigh at the scene of the crime, the defense could follow up and say, Well, who else did you see with Mr. McVeigh? And every one of them would say the same thing. And there was no answer that the prosecution had for this other person.
Yeah. And you know what? Such an important part of this story is the media rolling over and going along with this. Yeah, I remember reading the Onion headline was incidents of angel sightings in Oklahoma City goes up by 70%, or just mocking these people for being Christians and believing that their loved ones might have gone to heaven or something. Instead of the obvious, Americans go for the lone bomber scenario and mocking and ridiculing the newspaper editor of Let's Count 'Em, right? Everybody except the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post, who they never really got it together. They ran good articles, but they never really said, hey, we have a real problem here, and tried to make a thing out of it. But meanwhile, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Miami Herald, the Houston Chronicle, the Dallas Morning News, the Los Angeles Times, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, just Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, and Tom Brokaw, and Lehrer and McNeil on the NewsHour, they all went along with pushing this story that this one guy did it. And the fact that they had journalists sitting in that trial and not saying, well, wait a minute. Who? What else is going on here that you're not telling us? Because you're clearly not telling us everything. And wanting to fight about that. You know, September 11th made it pale in comparison in the public imagination. But what about in the 6 years in between, when this was the biggest deal in the world? Other than O.J. Simpson, which obscured the importance of it for a year there. But still, we're talking about 168 dead government employees and their babies. And they were able to cover this up to such a degree and get away with it with this hoax that it was this one guy with his Ryder truck, and that his closest co-conspirator was 200 miles away in another state at the time that the bomb detonated, and hold the right. Biggest trial circus in the world without calling a single witness to put him at the scene of the crime, which was in downtown Oklahoma City right at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Right. And it, you know, while it is an outrage that that's what the official narrative has become, one thing that really plays into this being the tragedy that it is and the injustice that it is that, you know, people have a short memory. Things will appear in the news and they'll come, and they'll go, and they'll maybe forget about them. And if a person goes and looks at this archive and they look at the news reports, just read them in a chronological order for April and May. Just read those first 2 months. And what you're going to find are newspapers that actually did publish interviews with witnesses who they found were credible. And you're going to be reading about people who saw John Doe number two, people who saw Timothy McVeigh at the scene of the crime, and every one of them seeing them with another person. And these were quoted in the paper. These were people who, in many cases, were very credible, a bank executive, you know, with Bank of Oklahoma.
Hey, John Doe too was the biggest manhunt in world history until he didn't exist. And it was all
right,
a big mistake.
That is what really caused a burning passion in me for this case, because I followed it in the paper and I'm thinking, okay, they're going to get John Doe number two one of these days. You know, it's been almost a month. And then I believe it was in June of 95 and the FBI said, he doesn't exist. I said, okay, I was born at night, but I wasn't born last night. Something is going on here. And I've been just very curious about it ever since. And the evidence that people can look at here was overwhelming, not just media accounts. There are FBI documents, Secret Service documents, just a whole host of things. And it's going to cause people to very quickly realize that there's more to this story.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to mention here, I see you have all your footnotes in the article that we're running today. Timothy McVeigh, suspects visit strip club in weeks before bombing by Richard Booth, April 9th, 2020 at the Libertarian Institute. Have you page down to the bottom? It's all your sources there. And the last one is the link to that YouTube video where people see and hear for themselves as the strippers talk about, boy, there was this weird, creepy guy who talked about how famous he's going to be one day out there, blah, 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 explaining all of that. And the context around it, too, I think taken from John Ronson's documentary there. And you know, people really should take a look at that so that they can see it for themselves.
Well, you know what, Scott, if people, if they view that video, and, you know, that'll be one shocking thing. But one thing that they can consider, and this is what I was thinking of when I wrote that article, is if Timothy McVeigh is going to be bragging to some stripper that he just met 5 minutes ago about how on April 19th she's going to remember him forever, and it's obviously then on his mind that evening, what are the odds he's going to discuss that same subject matter with the people that he's there at the club with? And I'd bet on those odds. Yeah, I bet if he talked about it that night with his dancer, he's going to be talking about it with the two people who are with him, which was, you know, Andrea Strassmeer and Mike Brescia. And I think that both of them might have some explaining to do.
Yeah.
And of course, Strassmeer.
And in fact, Strassmeyer admitted to Ambrose Evans Pritchard essentially that he was guilty. You know, he admitted it in rhetorical question form. Like, yeah, but how could I come forward if it was all my fault in the first place because I was an agent provocateur? I got to go. I forgot the exact quote, but it's very much like that.
It was incredibly incriminating. If you read Ambrose Evans Pritchard's interview with Andrea Strassmeyer, Pritchard did an amazing job as an investigative journalist. He all but got this guy to admit that he was in the truck 5 minutes before the bomb went off. And since then, Strassmeyer has gotten much better with PR, and he does now deny things. I deny never knowing McVeigh. I deny this, deny that. But if you go back and look at what he said to Ambrose Evans Pritchard in 1997, he certainly had a different tune at that time. And anybody who studies this guy and looks into his history, they're going to find that a person does not just up and decide one day that they're a neo-Nazi and say, I think I'm going to move into a neo-Nazi compound. One day they're normal, the next day they're a neo-Nazi. That doesn't happen. And so people,
I have the book here, but all my footnotes, all my bookmarks have fallen out. So I'm not going to be able to read you all the quote, unfortunately. The book is called The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, which is a stupid title, and it's not even about Bill Clinton at all. He's hardly even in the book. But that's what the publisher called it to get it read. But it's Ambrose Evans Pritchard from The Telegraph, and it's solid journalism on Oklahoma City. You know, everyone will really appreciate it. Sorry, I don't have that. I pulled it off the shelf, and I used to have this book was full of little yellow post-it note bookmarks, but they're all gone now. But, you know, something else that was in that video, that same documentary, is, and this is something that was in Pritchard's book, that I always cited Pritchard's book for this, but it turns out that John Ronson has Bob Ricks on video, and people will remember Bob Ricks was the spokesman for the FBI during Waco. So whenever you see on Waco, the rules of engagement, and the guy is up there going, we put massive gas in there, and the women and children had to have been suffering. That's him, Bob Ricks. And he was the head of the Tulsa office of the FBI. And he admits on camera to John Ronson that, yes, the ATF had an investigation into this Nazi compound that you mentioned, Elohim City, out east of Tulsa there. And that he shut them down. He's happy to admit that he stopped the ATF. He was afraid they were going to do another stupid Waco raid. And after all, they might, right? But then the implication was, we'll handle it. But then they didn't handle anything at all. And in fact, it looks like undercover informant who was informing the ATF about this conspiracy there at the time, Carol Howe, was actually informing on a conspiracy that was made up of a bunch of FBI informants. And I don't know exactly who Strassmeyer was working for, or if you do. But most of those guys were informants or flip state's witnesses. You know, the important ones involved in the Aryan Republican Army and all of that kind of thing there. And so maybe that's the reason why Bob Ricks never did follow up on the ATF's investigation that really was leading somewhere.
You raise a very good point, and I think I have a little bit of an alternative viewpoint on that. And
okay,
go ahead. To let people know the circumstances, it is just as you said. Basically, the ATF is about to do a raid on Elohim City. They've had an undercover investigation. They have proof that laws are being broken. They know that firearms there are being converted to automatic. They have their informant. They're ready to have a raid. And they have a meeting with the FBI. Bob Ricks is at this meeting, like you mentioned. And what happens here is the FBI puts a halt to the raid. And now here's where I have this alternative opinion. Bob Ricks says that the reason for halting that raid is he wanted to prevent another Waco. Well, this is how I look at it. What if Bob Ricks or his people at the FBI had an ongoing intelligence gathering operation at Elohim City and they had an informant in place? That operation would be just completely ripped apart and just crapped on if another agency comes in and does some kind of raid. And so I
and
think
that makes sense then too, that whoever the FBI's informant was, or if it was more than one, that they were essentially double agents shining the FBI on while they were planning this attack, which would also go to explain the two Ryder trucks, that it's abundantly clear that there were two different trucks. And so one of them was the decoy for the idiot feds to chase around in circles, while the other one was actually full of a bomb.
Right, right. And, you know, interestingly, that's the sort of tactic that was practiced by one member of this Aryan Republican Army bank robbery squad, that one of their members, Richard Lee Guthrie. This guy was really an antisocial personality, but very, very intelligent. And what he would do is he would actually get drop cars and he would register them in the names of FBI agents, or he would get two drop cars that were the same make and model. And so they'd have two cars that were identical. He did these sort of smoke and mirrors type tricks because he's thinking ahead. He knows an investigation is going to be coming up, and he's thinking, what can I do to confuse that investigation? So when we talk about the potential of there being two Ryder trucks, which is what the witnesses bear out, I look at that and think, now that's a Richard Guthrie tactic. And there's a lot of material people can dig into to see what potential links are between the Aryan Republican Army and McVeigh. But I'll just say this. The FBI believed that Timothy McVeigh was involved in bank robbery. His sister told the FBI that he told her that he was involved in bank robbery and had her launder some proceeds from it. And they believed the bank robberies financed the Oklahoma City bombing. And, well, the biggest bank robbery group at that time, who had the exact same ideological beliefs as Timothy McVeigh, were the Aryan Republican Army.
And so ties to Elohim City, which is right down the block from the strip club.
Ties to Elohim City, where there's a place where they all congregate. And the strip club, it's in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
But Tulsa is, if you're going to go to a big city, if you're going to leave the compound Elohim City, you're probably going to go to Tulsa, or you're probably going to go to Oklahoma City.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, we're out of time for this and got to run, but there you have it, everybody. The beginnings. Oh, I want to mention, I have to mention here, you mentioned Guthrie, and that for people who are familiar, who've been listening to this show for a while, you've heard me interview Jesse Trinidu, whose brother Kenny was murdered by the cops, the federal cops, at a transfer station in the summer of 95, and it's virtually certain that he was a case of mistaken identity and that the cops thought he was Guthrie. And that's how the confrontation with him began and how he ended up dead, which is a long, complicated story. But in the archives, you can find In Search of John Doe 2 by James Ridgway in Mother Jones, an excellent piece on it. And in my archives, you can find all my interviews with Jesse. I don't know how many there are, 5 or 10 or something, going back over the years about that. And so I'll really encourage people to pick up the trail from that end if you want as well. Great stuff there. And that's it. I'm sorry we got to go. But everybody, that is Richard Booth. And he wrote this piece, Timothy McVeigh, Suspects Visit Strip Club in Weeks Before Bombing. That's at the Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org. And he has compiled this magnificent archive of original source material on the truth behind the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995. And we have it all for you. For free, of course, at libertarianinstitute.org/OKC. Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. It's always a pleasure, and I'm glad to work with you to bring this this archive to the public.
And boy, am I glad that you are, too. Man, it's really something else that we have this. So thanks again, for sure. The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. APSradio.com antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.